Welcome to Twin Wisdoms. Today we explore Dead Air, a Throne on Subscription. When Monoto Television ceased satellite broadcasting on 31st January 2024, the event was widely read as a financial failure, and the channel's subsequent history did little to dislodge that reading. A diminished online operation followed. Then, in February 2026, even live programming was suspended after the channel was evicted from its London premises. Its landlord having been warned by UK counter-terrorism police of a credible threat. These two events have distinct proximate causes. One commercial, one a security eviction, and an honest account must keep them apart. But they share a single underlying condition, and it is that condition, rather than either trigger, that repays examination. The most recent decision of May 2026 is yet another final blow. Across 15 years, Monoto never built a base of support capable of sustaining it. That is a narrower claim than the one usually pressed against Monoto, and it is also a sturdier one. It does not require us to identify a paymaster, and it does not collapse the moment a complicating fact, an eviction, a security threat, enters the picture. It rests instead on something the channel's own history makes plain. Monoto's funding was opaque from the outset. The channel, owned by the Marjan Television Network and run by Kaven and Marjan Abbasi, consistently declined to identify its backers. A 2011 study by the Foreign Policy Center, a London think tank, attributed its financing to unnamed venture capitalists, a description that explains very little, since venture capital does not ordinarily underwrite a loss-making political and cultural broadcaster for more than a decade without a commercial exit. Iranian state outlets have, at various points, named the Pentagon, Saudi Arabia, and Israel as sponsors. Those claims are interested, unverified, and should be treated as such. What is not seriously in dispute is the scale of the losses. In 2019, Iran's then ambassador to London circulated what he presented as Monoto's balance sheet, asserting that of roughly $95 million in capital, only some $3 million represented income the channel had itself earned. The source is adversarial, and the figure should be discounted accordingly. Yet the order of magnitude is consistent with everything else known about the operation. A 24-hour satellite channel with substantial archival production, London salaries, and satellite carriage costs, sustained year upon year by capital it did not generate. Whatever the precise numbers, Monoto was not a business that paid its way, and it never claimed to be one. This is the fact from which the analysis should proceed, and it can be stated without speculation about any particular government. The temptation here is to reason by elimination. The public did not fund it. The Pahlavi family did not fund it. Therefore, a state did. That inference is weaker than it looks, because the list of remaining possibilities is longer than two. A loss-making exile broadcaster can be carried by a handful of wealthy private donors, emigre businessmen, figures with pre-revolutionary fortunes, without any state involvement at all. This is, in fact, the commonest funding model for diaspora media. It can be carried by a single patron, treating the outlet as a personal political project. It can run for years on a mixture of thin advertising revenue, entertainment programming, and patient capital that is never recouped. State sponsorship is one hypothesis among several, and the evidence in the public domain does not on its own single it out. But notice that the argument does not need it to. Every one of these explanations, wealthy donors, a single patron, indulgent capital, or a foreign treasury, shares one feature. None of them is a broad, organic donor base. That is the robust finding, and it holds regardless of which suspect one favors. Monoto was sustained by concentrated money, not by its public. When, in its final years, it appealed openly to viewers and subscribers to keep it alive, the appeal failed, and it failed at the very moment when, by the movement's own account, monarchist sentiment was at its height. It is worth being concrete about what an organic base would have had to look like. A satellite operation of Monoto's kind costs, conservatively, somewhere in the tens of millions of dollars a year. To replace even a modest fraction of that through subscriptions, say at $15 a month, requires a sustained paying membership in the high tens of thousands, renewing month after month. That is not a sentiment, it is an institution. It implies dues, lists, organized fundraising, and a structure that converts feeling into recurring revenue. This is where the familiar charge of hypocrisy should be set aside, because it is both unkind and analytically lazy. Individuals routinely decline to fund a shared good, each assuming others will carry it. The ordinary free rider problem, and no evidence of insincerity. The point is not that individual monarchists are hypocrites. The point is structural. A genuine movement builds the machinery that defeats free riding. It creates the party, the membership tier, the foundation, the disciplined campaign. The diaspora monarchist current produced none of these. Its characteristic activity has been the rally and the commemorative gathering, episodic, expressive, and unmonetized. Whatever else such gatherings are, they are not a funding constituency, and an outlet that depends on one cannot be sustained by them. The funding collapse does not prove foreign state sponsorship. What it establishes is something prior and, for the argument, sufficient: the absence of an organic constituency. And here the two readings that might otherwise compete. It was state-funded, and the diaspora was never a movement, in fact converge on the same conclusion. If a state paid, the public base was a fiction. If no state paid, the public base still failed to materialize when it was finally asked to appear. Either way, the mass support was not there. The deeper significance lies in what Minotto principally sold. Its signature product was pre-revolutionary archival footage, and the affect it traded in was nostalgia for a pre-1979 Iran of decency and ease. But most of Minotto's audience, and certainly its younger audience, has no first-hand memory of that Iran. The longing the channel cultivated was therefore not a memory being recovered. It was a sentiment being manufactured, and manufactured continuously, by an apparatus that had to be paid for. Nostalgia of this kind is not self-sustaining. Remove the production line, and the feeling does not vanish overnight. But it loses its renewal, its imagery, its weekly reinforcement. A movement resting on manufactured memory is uniquely exposed to the loss of the factory. The companion case held to the same standard, the parallel case is Iran International, and intellectual consistency requires holding it to the evidential standard applied to Minotto. Here the record is firmer. UK corporate filings and reporting in the Wall Street Journal indicate that the channel was founded and funded by figures connected to the Saudi royal court. Its original backing is therefore not merely alleged, but documented. What followed that backing, whether it continued, lapsed, or was replaced after the Tehran, Riyadh rapprochement, is genuinely uncertain, and claims about a subsequent source should be presented as conjecture, not finding. The honest statement is the limited one. One of the two most prominent monarchist-aligned broadcasters had a documented foreign state origin, and the other was sustained by undisclosed concentrated money. Neither rested on its public. This bears on a wider difficulty for the exile project. Reza Pahlavi has, in recent years, repeatedly framed change in Iran as something that will require external pressure, and has at times spoken of the support of foreign governments as a necessary condition rather than an embarrassment. One may read those statements charitably or critically, but a political program that locates the decisive agency outside the country, and that is amplified by media it does not itself fund, will always struggle to demonstrate that it speaks for a domestic constituency rather than merely about one. To call this the end of monarchism would be to overreach. An idea does not die because a television channel goes dark. Ideologies have survived with far less infrastructure than a satellite license, and Iran's own modern history shows how thin a medium can carry a political current a long way. What has ended is something more specific and more consequential. For 15 years, an externally financed, archive-driven apparatus lent the monarchist project a reach, a polish, and an appearance of mass depth that its actual base never supplied. That apparatus is now substantially gone, and the appeals to replace it have gone unanswered. The monarchist current is therefore left to discover whether it can exist as what it has always claimed to be, a popular movement, without the machinery that, for a decade and a half, disguised the fact that it was not yet one. That is not the end of an idea. It is the end of an illusion about the idea's depth. And for a political project, the second loss may prove harder to recover from than the first. Thank you for listening to Twin Wisdoms.